Timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Cut, Quantel, opt in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
Well, it is Saturday, the 25th of March in the glorious future year of 2023. I am coming to you from Munich, the capital of the Free State of Bavaria in southern Germany, where I have laryngitis or something. Nearly lost my voice. But I'm doing my show anyway. If you hear me, what sounds like drinking tea sometime during this broadcast, you should know that it's not tea. It is, in fact, an infusion of ginger. Just like that. Now, what am I here to talk to you about today? Well, I'm mostly here to talk about quantitative thinking. And, admittedly, quantitative thinking is an exercise that many people are very uncomfortable engaging in. They don't like it. It makes them feel icky. But, in the end, it's very important, right? Because the answers to quantitative questions, such as, do we have enough food to make it through the winter, really are a matter of life and death. You know, the ancients thought of two different kinds of quantity, magnitudes and multitudes. In other words, a multitude answers the word how many of countable things, whether that be human beings or stars or grains of corn. And a magnitude answers the question how big, like the height of a mountain or the breadth of a river. We've mostly unified those in sort of two surprising or even contradictory ways. One is by the use of units, so that we can say 35 miles per hour, and we pretend that miles and hours are countable things, when really they're kind of more like approximations. And then, of course, at the other end of the scale, there's quantum theory, which tells us that whatever is continuous, or seems continuous to the senses, is really discrete units. Sort of intriguing paradox there. But when it comes to quantitative thinking, well, as an example, earlier this week, right, on my way from my home in Texas to Bavaria here, I had a stopover in Istanbul. It's a well worth seeing if you ever have the chance. And it's quite an enormous city, a population of more than 15 million people. And this inspired me to go look at IAEARDS-2, the International Atomic Energy Agency's publication, Nuclear Power Reactors in the World, and work out how much of world nuclear power is in what I'll call small countries, where I define small as having less population than Istanbul. Now, total there are currently 33 countries in the world that have nuclear power, although if the situation in Germany continues unchanged, that number will be 32 after the 15th of April. Nuclearia Nuclearia, the German pro-nuclear citizen organization, is arranging a demonstration in Berlin April 15th, which I plan to attend, on the theme, Nuclear Will Win. And they say that because when you think about it quantitatively, there's really no energy policy for the world that works in any way, shape, or form that doesn't involve substantial amounts of fission. None that we can see our way to now, anyway. And that's kind of the key here. Thoughts and prayers is not an energy policy. Thoughts and prayers is not a basis for making decisions which shape the fate of nations. But that is what is being done in the world today, I'm sorry to say. Now, there has been some chatter in the news recently that the head of the Green Party is becoming dissatisfied and may break up the coalition government. And if she does that before the 15th of April, it's an outside possibility that the FDP will caucus with the CSU-CDU and that they will stop the nuclear shutdown. But I don't give that a more than 5% chance of happening. So, what are the 12 small nuclear countries? That is to say, smaller in population than Istanbul. Well, arranged alphabetically, they are Armenia, Belarus, Belgium, Bulgaria, Czech Republic, Finland, Hungary, Slovakia, Slovenia, Sweden, Switzerland, and the United Arab Emirates. I know we have at least one member, Tanakian, who frequently listens from Argentina. From Armenia, rather. I know we have a member who listens from Uruguay. I don't know about Argentina. Now, it's interesting. The number of power reactors in these small countries ranges from one in Armenia, Belarus, and Slovenia. That's operating, currently operating reactors. To seven in Belgium, although I believe Tihange 2 has just been shut down, so that number should be amended to 6. These are figures as of the end of 2021. Anyway, the share, again this is for 2021, of nuclear electricity in those countries ranges from 52.3% in Slovakia, in Belgium it's 50.8%, in Hungary it's 46.8, all the way down to 1.3% in the UAE, although I must say that with the Barakah units continuing to come online and spending more of their year online, that number is going up rapidly. Now, somehow I've averaged that. I got to look at my spreadsheet and figure out what I did to average those averages, because I think that may mean nothing. What does that actually mean? That's an absolutely meaningless figure. I'm actually going to delete that from my spreadsheet because it means nothing. Okay. But yeah, and if you're wondering, the other countries, the 21 large countries, are Argentina, Brazil, Canada, People's Republic of China, France, Germany, India, Iran, Japan, Republic of Korea, Mexico, Netherlands, Pakistan, Romania, Russian Federation, South Africa, Spain, Taiwan, Republic of China, Ukraine, United Kingdom, and United States of America. And again, the number of operating power reactors ranges from 1 in Iran to 93 in the United States, and their installed capacity goes from 482 in the Netherlands, which also has one reactor, all the way to 95,523 in the USA. And the proportion of nuclear electricity, and again this is for 2021, goes from 1% in Iran, all the way up to 69% in France. Ukraine is 55%. Korea 28%, and again, they have a phase-out policy. I don't know what they think they're going to do. Thoughts and prayers is not an energy policy. I find these quantitative measures very interesting. As I was telling you last time, I've been very much startled by this proposal by the European Union to reduce final energy consumption by 11.7%. And I promised that I would work out which countries does that mean eliminating from the EU. And so what I did was to take the whole list, and I took their population, GDP, and primary energy supply as of 2019, which I have figures for. Those are reasonably reliable figures. It'll be another year or two before we get, I think, good figures again. I ordered them in three different ways, descending by population, descending by GDP, and descending by primary energy supply. Now, because of inefficiencies in energy conversion and transformation and transmission, primary energy supply doesn't map one-to-one to final energy consumption, but it's more, it's much easier to calculate that way, and I think it is a reasonable approach. So, depending on how you sort. Basically, I just then went up from the bottom, adding together the fraction of primary energy supply in each country, went up from the bottom until I reached the first number that was bigger than 11.7 and cut it there. So depending on how you look at it, depending on which way you sort, you have to completely eliminate 13, 14, or 15 of the countries of the European Union with between 52 and 68 million people. Just imagine that they're cut right off the map. Imagine they're annihilated by hydrogen bombs, right? Those people, those countries just go away forever. That's what it means to reduce your primary, to reduce your energy use by 11.7%. Now, in case you're wondering, the countries that get cut off include Austria, Bulgaria, Denmark, Finland, Slovakia, Ireland, Croatia, Lithuania, Slovenia, Latvia, Estonia, Cyprus, Luxembourg, Malta, Czech Republic in some cases, Hungary in some cases, Greece in some cases. So there's eight that always get lost. Right, no, ten that always get lost, which are Slovakia, Luxembourg, Bulgaria, Croatia, Slovenia, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Cyprus, and Malta. And then there are eight others which appear on one or two lists, but not all of them. And I've put that in the non-radio post for the day. That's what I want you to think about, is that when they talk about energy savings, what they're really talking about is energy austerity. And when they talk about energy austerity, what they're effectively talking about is eliminating a dozen and more countries with 50 to 70 million people from the European Union. That's pretty insane. And as a result, I think that this target of 11.7% austerity target is probably not going to happen. But I really do want to make up some colorful charts and graphs to show this, and probably mail them to the governments at a very minimum of those countries that would be cut off. You know, mail them to the energy minister, mail them to the prime minister even, and say, hey, you might want to think about this a second. This is not good for individual countries or for the EU. Now, Again, quantitative thinking. What have I been thinking about quantitatively recently? Well, there was certainly an interesting bit. You know, there's been a great focus recently, not just on carbon dioxide emissions as potentially contributing to global climate change, but also methane emissions. Now, methane emissions come from various sources. For example, from badly handled natural gas wells. But also from agriculture. And so there was a report about the largest sources of methane emissions from agriculture. And of course, unsurprisingly, number one is meat, number two is dairy. Number three, however, is rice. Now, why? Well, it has to do essentially with draining and reflooding the rice paddies, which you have to do every time you plant new rice plants. And so there's a great deal of interest right now in reducing the degree to which that has to be done by getting multiple crops from the same rice plant. Now, ordinary rice plants will yield multiple crops. But, you know, the first crop, you get a good yield. The second crop, you get a mediocre yield. The third crop, you get a frankly poor yield. And so it's not normally done. There is quite a bit of interest in mutation breeding and other techniques which would allow better multi-cropping, even at the cost of a somewhat reduced yield from the first crop, which looks like it may be a trade-off that has to be made. Now, of course, a lot of people want to ban or severely restrict animal husbandry. Even in countries where that's a major part of the economy, you know, there's talk about making it extremely difficult in the Netherlands, which of course is well known for its dairy industry. And now I'm thinking, is this the end of Dutch cheese? Is this the Gouda Damerung? I'll let you savor that one for a minute. Gouda Damerung. But something that occurred to me, which I found very interesting when I first read it some time back. So in the 1940s, I suppose, when penicillin became widely available, it was discovered that adding antibiotics to animal feed caused those animals to gain weight more rapidly or produce more milk or whatever it is you're trying to do. But obviously you don't want to do that because it results in the proliferation of antibiotic-resistant bacteria, pathogens. You really don't want that. But just as with the positive response of people in certain countries to ivermectin, deworming medication during the COVID pandemic, this is because there's a sort of background body burden of pathogens. So in countries where worms are endemic, if you give people anti-worm medication, it lightens the load on their immune system and they bounce back quicker from whatever else it is that they have. Similarly, if you do something about the background load of pathogens in livestock, then they're going to convert their food more efficiently into meat and milk, which is what you, or eggs, which is what you're cultivating them for. Because, of course, here's the key thought. Methane, of course, is highly calorific. If it weren't highly calorific, we wouldn't use it as a fuel, right? It stands to reason that any methane which is escaping from the animal is carrying away calories which could otherwise go to meat or milk or eggs, whatever it, or wool, whatever it is that you're growing the animal for, whatever it is you're raising the animal for. So that's the key thing to think about. If we can improve the efficiency of food utilization by livestock by possibly 10%, that's going to come straight out of their fugitive methane emissions, which may result in a substantial decrease of those emissions. And I haven't seen that proposed anywhere. Now, the question is, how do you do it? Because, again, we don't want to feed antibiotics to cattle, right? Well, it was discovered in the 50s that irradiating livestock feed had the same result, presumably because it killed all manner of microorganisms that, when they got into the animal, would be pathogenic or parasitic in that effect. So it's possible that by irradiating livestock feed, we can reduce the fugitive methane emissions. And similarly, by putting recombiners, perhaps, in barns, basically little catalytic burners, to consume the methane, combine it with atmospheric air to produce water vapor and carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide, a greenhouse gas, yes, but a much less potent one than methane. This is a thought. I don't know. I'm not certain whether that's a good idea. In the long run, I think, quite aside from people's disapproval of animal husbandry and various other things, you know, the introduction of plant-based meat and dairy substitutes, which are eventually going to get to the point of being both in terms of nutritional profile and in terms of flavor and texture qualities and so on, desirable for people who don't have restricted diets to begin with. I really do think that we will probably have to be moving away from stall feeding of cattle, feedlots, that kind of thing. You know, there's a lot of land which is not very arable that you can graze cattle, sheep, and goats on, but using arable land for producing sorghum and alfalfa to feed to cattle is probably a pretty bad idea, particularly when you're not just using arable land, you're using irrigation water. In Kansas, for example, where it's coming from the Ogallala water aquifer, which I've talked about before, when you're using nitrate fertilizer, when you're using pesticides, it's probably a good idea to confine those things to human food. And of course, you can't, this is obvious, you can't irradiate forage. It's just not any reasonable in any way, shape, or form. So if your cattle and sheep and goats are grazing on marginal land, you're not going to be able to irradiate their feed. I don't know. What I do know is that there have been people working on using natural gas to make livestock feed. In other words, taking fossil methane, feeding it to methane-metabolizing bacteria, and then using those bacteria, the carbohydrates and proteins they produce, as feed for cattle. Now, if you do have cattle feedlots and livestock barns, and you can capture the methane, even in a form mixed with air, and bubble it into the culture tanks for these methane-metabolizing bacteria, and then harvest them to feed the cows, at least you're helping to close the cycle. So I have some hope of improvement there. But, you may not hear that proposal from anyone else, but you've heard it from me, and that's what I'm here for. Right? Not just to tell you things that you've heard before from other people, but hopefully also to tell you things that you haven't. Now, I'm going to mention, I was on the IAEA PRIS website, that's International Atomic Energy Agency Power Reactor Information System website, and they've had a couple of really nifty-looking posters showing the current state of nuclear energy in the world, and there was a thing that says, oh, that you can request these posters from the administrator, and so I've sent off an email to see if I can get some. We'll see what happens there. Now, what else is there to say? I should mention, because of the sore throat, and as you can imagine, I've said almost not a word today. I've been saving up my voice for you. I'm not going to be doing a video live stream on TubeNex tomorrow, so you'll have to wait another week for the continuation of All Men Are Brothers, The Water Margin. But beginning Tuesday, hopefully, assuming I've got my voice back, I will be reading from Vignettes in Nuclear Medicine by Marshall Brucer, which is about atomic energy in an application far from the power plant, but his writing style is very lively, and he communicates some basic concepts in an excellent manner. I just really like his writing, and he's good at communicating the concepts, so I'm going to read that for you. Now, getting back to quantitative thinking, I read a study the other day from Washington University of St. Louis, and what it was talking about was the sizing a system of solar power plus storage to meet the electricity needs of the St. Louis metro area, which they modeled by 270 by 270 kilometer square centered on St. Louis City. But that's not the point. The point is they did some really intriguing things to model the variation of solar irradiation. Basically, they generated a large number of model years with statistical qualities similar to those of the 40 years of data they actually have. This is really interesting work. Now, why are they doing this? As I may have mentioned on this show before, if you try to build a solar system that generates just enough energy over the course of a year, and then storage to move it from when it's available to when it's needed, you need storage for at least 30% of your total annual output, which is very expensive and difficult to do. So, generally speaking, people plan to overbuild the solar system in order to make the storage system much smaller, and they think they can get away with a couple of days' worth. And in this particular case, they worked it out that they could build a solar system which is about 1.2 times the minimum size to generate the average energy demand on the winter solstice, that's fine, and 2 days' worth of storage. And the whole thing was to cost $94 billion. Now, there were two flaws that I identified with this immediately. The first was, after all the trouble they went to model the variation from day to day, year to year, of solar energy input, they modeled the system load as being absolutely constant, every day in the year the same, which is, of course, utterly absurd. For one thing, and this is the worst, right? In the winter, electricity demand tends to rise as solar energy input decreases. Anyway, so the system they so very carefully modeled could not actually handle the real load. I don't know why they didn't go and model the system load the same way. By the way, the minimum size of solar array they were talking about that was just barely capable of meeting that average year-round demand on the winter solstice, 16 by 16 kilometers. 256 square kilometers. Kind of a big object. Anyway, well, I went through it and I took the figure and I said, well, you know, for that much money, even at the insanely high prices of the Hinkley Point C and Vogtle 3 and 4 nuclear projects, far and away the most expensive nuclear projects, you could buy 10 gigawatts. So they're talking about an average load of 4.6 gigawatts, which is what they plan to serve. Well, 10 gigawatts of nuclear generation would be able to serve not only an average load of 4.6 gigawatts, including refueling outages, but would also account for a 2-to-1 excess of peak load over average load. You know, 100% nuclear system is generally considered to be way too expensive, but in this case, it would only cost as much as the solar system. At the price of Barakah, the UAE plant built by the Koreans, you'd get 30 gigawatts, which would be enough to triple your total electricity take, assuming that you're replacing gasoline cars with electric cars, replacing gas heaters with electric heaters, and all of that. But it turns out it's worse than that. Because a reasonable PV system will have a system lifetime between 12 and 20 years before it has to be replaced. Storage batteries between 6 and 10 years. Nuclear, PWR nuclear, 40 to 60 years. So as it turns out, when you just do a straight line depreciation, as it turns out, when you cost, you know, the costs as stated, right? The annual cost for the solar system plus storage on the most favorable assumption is about $8.5 billion. The annual cost for the nuclear system under the least favorable assumption, the 40-year lifetime assumption, is only $3.5 billion, which is to say about 40%, less than 40%, as a matter of fact. So a 100% nuclear system is actually only 40% of the cost. Anyway, you've been listening to A Step Further Out on AnonRadio.net, a service of the SDF Public Access Unix System. Visit patreon.com/man_and_Adam.